I want to talk about volatility now. 2018 was an extraordinary year for volatility, and it seems to be becoming the new normal. Let's talk about managing the risk caused by market volatility with David Gracie, who's the head of FIC trading, fixed income and currency trading and investing in Johannesburg, and his colleague Denvan Naidu, head of fixed income trading at that same institution. Gentlemen, I love volatility because it makes for good radio and it makes for good broadcasting. Do you embrace it or do you fear it?
Lindsay, hi. I think a bit of both. You know, volatility is part of our world, and it's something that we are conscious of all the time. And without volatility, there would be no need for our desks and what we do. So certainly we do embrace it. But at times, volatility can get a bit extreme. And, you know, those volatility jumps are becoming more and more sort of regular. So you have to be, it's something you have to be conscious of and watch all the time. So in answer to your question, a little bit of both, actually.
Good. Denvan, do you echo those sentiments?
Yeah, I think just something to add is generally with heightened volatility, liquidity drops off quite a bit. So that does affect our market-making businesses.
Of course, it is very important because I suppose the short-term speculators want to embrace, as I said, that's that word again, embrace. They want to take on the risk that volatility sort of provides them, whereas people like yourselves, when you're managing massive, massive flows on behalf of your clients and also your proprietary trading, which we'll come to in a moment, I suppose it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? Do you both have different roles? In other words, do you both have proprietary trading responsibilities as well as investment management responsibilities?
Well, I think by the nature of our business, we do provide liquidity to a quite broad client base, which naturally sources risk, and as a consequence, you're exposed to that volatility. So as I said earlier, it's something that you absolutely have to be aware of, and you have to be conscious all the time of extreme price movements or something that may move a price, you know, once you've sourced that risk. So, you know, it is something that we watch very, very closely. And I think we have to differentiate a little bit then between implied volatility and sort of historic or actual volatility, because they are two different things, and maybe we need to just explain what we mean by those two different factors, implied volatility versus historic or real volatility.
Yeah, maybe you could do that, Denvan, because I don't understand the distinction at all as a layman. Maybe you could explain for us.
Implied volatility is what the market's pricing in going forward, and historical volatility is what actually was experienced. So implied is where we think it's going to be based on future developments, and generally there's a spread between implied and historically. What we've seen is your implied generally runs a lot higher than your historic volatility. Certainly has been the case in SA. Dave, you agree with that?
Yeah, I think implied volatility is what your options trader would use to price into his model how he provides that options price to a client, and he would use implied volatility, and I guess that's really a factor of supply and demand in the market. And then your historic volatility is your actual measurement over time. As Denvan points out, they do trade, they are two different things, and there's generally a gap. And the reason that implied volatility generally trades higher, I say generally, over a period of time, is because options traders want to price in the potential for extreme unexpected price moves. So you would have your implied volatility built into your options model that would generally trade a little bit higher than historic volatility, just to give the options trader some protection against extreme price movements in the future.
Has there been a widening of the spread between historic and implied volatility because of things like, for example, Denvan, algorithmic trading? I mean, it seems to me, and I can remember this distinctly, I was on an Investec Asset Management roadshow around about a year ago, early February in 2018, and I was sitting at the Sandton Sun Hotel, and I was watching the Dow Jones, and it was going down in 100-point clips, or it seemed to me to be doing so on the television, because I don't think the systems could keep up with what was going on. And that almost to me said, this is going to become normal in the future. Do you find that the implied versus historic is going to become wider or has become wider?
I think it's a difficult one to answer right now. I think there has been cases of that in extreme events. You know, certainly when we see quite a spike in volatility for a once-off sort of event that the market hasn't priced in, we've seen some forced movement from the algo trading systems. So they sort of once they get into certain levels in the market, they push through, and then it's self-fulfilling prophecy, basically, with algorithmic trading. So for me, I think it's very difficult to say now whether it has increased it substantially enough to say that it's going to be at heightened levels in the future.
If I could just come in, Lindsay, I think the advent of trading systems or algorithmic systems, algos as they're known in short, they have been the cause of dramatic price movements in various asset classes in the past, and that's what Denman's alluding to here. The algorithm in the background itself, once it starts trying to digest the information that the system is trying to fathom, it may become self-fulfilling in the sense that the systems themselves are generating sell orders and continuous sell orders, which move the price through the level, which creates another sell order. So we certainly believe that these algo systems have created extreme volatility in the past, but there are also times where these algorithmic systems are, in fact, providing more liquidity than ordinarily would be observed in the market. So again, sometimes they are decreasing volatility essentially, but in extreme price moves, I do believe that they add to the volatility of that asset class.
In other words, they're increasing the volatility, increasing the liquidity, but also increasing, perhaps, if you're an astute trader, an astute manager of risk, giving you an opportunity as well. Because if you see something that has blown out to such an extent that you think this is not fair value, or it's overpriced or it's underpriced, that gives you an opportunity to help your either proprietary trading or your clients.
Yeah, I think that would be right. You know, it depends on the asset class. So, for example, in an equity, there's some kind of fundamental evaluation that you can apply to a company, be it a price-earnings ratio, be it some other kind of measurement that would be a standard observable within the market. And if the algorithmic system happens to push the price of that stock to such an extreme level that you know, it becomes clearly stupid to an observer, then humans would step in and look for value and provide some kind of support. In the currency market, that's less easy to observe. It's very difficult to fundamentally value a currency. You know, if we look early in the year, in 2018, the Turkish lira was a prime example where the currency moved 40% overnight, almost in one direction in a couple of minutes. And what that did was place the entire banking system in peril, because people had borrowed, the consumers in Turkey had borrowed a huge amount of money out of Europe, unhedged, and when the Turkish lira depreciated, they found their interest rate payments going through the roof. So the volatility in the market created a systemic problem for the Turks, and as a consequence, they had to raise their own domestic rates up to, I think, 22-23%. So we see these price moves actually creating real-world problems, and the two are interlinked. You really can't get away from it, and in my view, in any case, volatility is here to stay. Mm. And, you know, my cynic sort of bearish nature always says to me that volatility is underpriced over the longer term. If you go read books like The Black Swan, that will explain exactly that scenario to you, that these extreme price movements wouldn't by definition mean that volatility is underpriced in the longer term.
Tried reading that book. It didn't get more than a third of the way through, David. But
it is a rather long read, Lindsay.
It really is. Denvin, give us an idea of how you manage volatility on a day-to-day basis in your capacity as head of fixed income trading. You don't have to give us names. You don't have to give us numbers. But just give us an idea of a typical volatility managing transaction that you would undertake.
Volatility managing transaction. I think a lot of the time, we have to be very aware of the different potential events and how these impact not only the risk we currently have on our books, but pricing our clients going forward. So a lot of the time is spent on forecasting potential scenarios so that in those situations, we would be able to provide liquidity to our clients. A lot of the time we spend buying optionality when we think the value is there, so that in the event of a blowout, we have protection against our market making. So it's a lot of that world, you know, sort of correlation, volatility levels. We always have to be aware of them all the time.
David, you've been a currency trader for as long as I can remember, and we've spoken many, many times about it. And here we are sitting with a rand that, because of the Eskom situation and maybe a couple of other international events as well, exerting pressure on it, it's gone from the 1320s against the US dollar to its current level of the high 1370s. What would you be doing on a day like this? Saying, well, it's the start of a new trend, or it's blown out, 50 cents in a week is too much. How do you approach it? What do you do?
I think Denman alluded to it. You know, Lindsay, you have to be aware of the potential factors that may drive future price movements. It's something that we constantly monitor and constantly aware of, trying to gauge the impact of certain things. Now, you know, in hindsight, it's very easy to say that around the 1320, with the Eskom problems and with the looming budget coming up in a few days' time, that the rand was arguably, you know, overdone, that the rand at 1325 looked a little bit extreme, and in hindsight, but possibly it did. But what you've got to remember is that not much longer than a week ago, you had a surprise statement from the Fed, far more dovish than the market expected. And as a consequence, you know, high-yielding currencies became vogue again. So it's not really about, it's being aware of the potential factors in the real world, politics, economics, that can affect future price movements. And if optionality is at a price where we think that it offers enough protection, then you would use some of those strategies in your favor. But it's really more awareness of the potential factors. And, you know, we, just to use the example that you've been alluding to, we've been talking about Eskom now for the better part of, I don't know, 18 months and more so in the last sort of 3 to 6 months, saying that in our opinion, and it's only our opinion for what it's worth, in our opinion that the market was underpricing the risks associated with Eskom's balance sheet. And, you know, we've seen that now with more load shedding, and in fact, a greater load shedding today than we've been accustomed to, from 2,000 megawatts to 4,000 megawatts. Now you have to start pricing in that impact on real GDP growth and what that's going to do to businesses around South Africa, and so on and so on and so forth. So it's not about single events. It's being aware of the various factors. And right now in the world, there's many of these factors. You know, politicians are creating problems, from Brexit to Donald Trump to Italy to wherever you want to look. And as a consequence, we do expect volatility to remain elevated and may be, in fact, in the near term, quite underpriced.
Denver, I gave a rather clumsy description earlier on when I asked a question. I said volatility managing a transaction, but that's just me. Do your clients understand the nature of volatility and the need for it to be managed, given what you've both just said and given the history of the last 12 months? 2018 was a year of heightened volatility. Do people understand that this might become the new normal?
Yeah, I think if we break it down on the fixed income side, we deal a lot with institutional clients. So they are very aware of the impact of volatility, and they certainly build their own in-house models to price it. So that client segment, yes, they're very much aware. I think more as you move into the corporate side of it, which is more on the FX business, I think less so.
Okay. Yeah, I think optionality, which has volatility as a big part of the pricing model, has over the years got itself quite a bad name. You know, we only see the scandals in the newspapers when people have been pricing instruments that have some kind of coupling to an underlying currency, but they haven't told their customers that, and then the currency blows out and this client base loses a fortune. That will make the newspapers. And that creates a certain fear factor about options in the various asset classes. I really do believe that the advent of optionality or options has really helped institutions and clients, corporates, whatever, you know, doesn't matter sort of which segment they fall into. But whether it's understood or not, I'm not sure. Because of the fear factor, maybe clients are less inclined to use options to hedge their exposures. And, you know, the exposures are manifest. I always have to smile a little bit when companies have to give their results. And a gold miner will say, well, you know, the gold price fell and therefore our results are poor. But when the gold price was rising, you know, it was down to their good management. But in fact, you can use optionality to hedge your exposures and to smooth those incomes. So I think there's a role for them to play. And I certainly believe that corporate treasurers need to be aware of them and how they can hedge out their risks and smooth their exposures over time.
That's where you two come in, of course, with smoothing exposures. And one of my it's not a bugbear, but it's an observation, is that the proliferation of products, whether it be the VIX, the volatility index, whether it be fancy options which need not detain us now because they're too complicated, all of those things have to be hedged themselves. So the market, of course, becomes more volatile, never mind the algo traders. Final question to both of you. In South Africa, and you've sort of alluded to it, both of you, do corporates and public institutions manage their volatility risk correctly? You're holding their hand, but they've got to push the button. Do they do it? Dendron, maybe start with you.
I think it's kind of human nature to underprice potential risk going forward. I mean, there's a lot of written in books, psychological books, you know, you see it a lot from guys that ran funds or current, the very successful fund managers. They speak about underpricing of risk. When it comes down to your Black-Scholes model for optionality, you know, the biggest problem with the model is that it underprices the tail risk. I think we've spoken a lot about algo trading and the increase of volatility. And what that's pointing towards is much fatter tails, which means that what used to be called a black swan event is not so much black swan anymore. It happens a lot more often and potentially more often in the future. So, yes, I do believe they underprice the risk. They don't manage it as efficient as they could. And largely based on what Dave said, you know, when the market goes in one direction, if it's their favor, they kind of, you know, use it as if it's part of their strategy all the time. And if it goes the other way, they just blame the markets.
David, final word from you. Do you echo that?
I think more and more, you know, large corporates are understanding the risks and pricing in those some of those risks. You know, I think the difficulty for some of these corporates is that, you know, if you're a motor car manufacturer, motor car exporter, that's your core business. You're manufacturing cars and selling them across the world. Understanding currency risk is not your core business. And as a consequence, your focus will naturally lie with where your strengths are. I think that's where banks and institutions and perhaps treasury outsourcers, that's where they come in to help these guys with what's not their core business to try and hedge these exposures and as a consequence, smooth them out. But I think more and more as we move into this complex world and as technology takes over, I think it would be rather short-sighted of anybody that's running these large institutions or large corporations not to be aware of the risks associated and to look at some of the products that are available to hedge out those risks.
Gentlemen, thanks so much for your fascinating insight. That was David Gracie, head of FIC trading at Investec in Johannesburg, and that's fixed income and currency trading. And he was joined by his colleague, Dendron Naidu, head of fixed income trading, also at Investec in Johannesburg.
The views expressed are those of the contributors at the time of publication and do not necessarily represent the views of the firm and should not be taken as advice or recommendation. Investec Specialist Bank, a division of Investec Bank Limited, is a registered credit provider.